his when they got us up and moving again. His breather's gone. My thoughts spin as the bottom falls out of my stomach. Mink outfitted me with a breather tank, delicately balancing carrying weight against time, so that it would have just enough oxygen to see me through to the scheduled rendezvous, which still has to be more than 2 weeks away, though I'd need to get back to the surface to know exactly what day it is. As long as I'm careful with it, limiting myself to the 8 hours a day my body needs, rather than the many more hours my body wants, it's enough. Enough for one person. Sharing my breather cuts that time in half, and I don't make it to the rendezvous. I don't make it off Gaia, and I don't make it back to Evie. My next breath is shaky and loud, its sound amplified by the mask over my face. Then I'm crawling forward, my shadow in the lantern light swinging around the surface of the rock wall as I cross to Jules' side. I pull off the mask and hold it out to him, hand shaking. His eyes flick up. Surprised confusion there. "You breathe," I whisper, "while I eat. Then we'll switch." His gaze holds mine for a long moment, searching. Our lies are there, like layers of dust and debris left by time and neglect, concealing the truths engraved beneath. I can't help but wonder if we've buried ourselves too deeply, if the honesty of that moment waking with his arm around me is as lost to history as the race who built this place. Then he sets down his journal and pencil and reaches out with both hands. One comes to rest against my shaking fingers, steadying them, while the other takes the mask. I exhale, and some of the dust choking my heart drifts away on the air, sighing past my lips. Our dinner is necessarily silent, and at this rate, it seems like conserving our air is a good idea. We switch after I finish my dinner, then switch again. Jules' head is bowed, hands dangling from his drawn-up knees, breath shallow in the confines of the mask. For the first time since Liz's gang jumped us, I pull out my phone. It's an old, battered junk heap of a thing. Years ago, everyone had one of these. They were so universal, they were like ID back before everything went digital. Now, there's a dozen different companies making newer, better versions with cutting-edge technologies this one lacks. Jules' wrist device, for one, with its holographic interface and its kinetic energy charger so that its battery never runs down. But the nice thing about these phones, even though they're ancient in technological terms, is that they're so universal, you can always find parts for them. They're sturdy, and they're cheap. And when you're a scavenger, you don't sport fancy tech unless you want some rival gang to rip you off in your sleep. It runs on solar power. Solar power that it hasn't seen in days. When I swipe my thumb over the screen, the little battery icon flashes a red warning before the circle for my thumbprint unlock appears. I probably only have a few more minutes before it dies on me. Even if the station were directly above us now, we're so far underground that there's no chance of a signal. I can't call anyone or get any data. If I tried to watch Evie's last video message, the battery would die instantly. I hunch over the screen, though, turning the brightness down to conserve power, and swipe until I get to my photo gallery. There's the selfie I sent to Evie right before I boarded the ship. And before it, a few promo shots of bits of salvage for auctioning online. I keep scrolling until I find the picture I'm looking for. It's the last time Evie and I were together. She still got her makeup on from work. The dark, smoky eyes and red lips making her look way older than 14. You can see her tracker bracelet at the picture's edge. The bracelet the club put around her wrist, attached to the bone in her arm by dozens of micro-anchors. The only way to remove it is by paying her impossible debt or lopping off her arm. Though it's hard to look past the makeup in the bracelet, she's wearing pajamas with pink elephants on them. And I'm in my PJs too, and we're snuggled close on the crappy couch in her room under the club that holds her contract. Our heads are together, and you can see my arm where I'm holding the phone up, and we're grinning. We'd been laughing about something right before I took the picture, and the smiles are real. I can't remember what we were laughing about. My eyes blur as my mind sticks on that, turning over and over and over. Why can't I remember the joke? Why can't I remember the last thing my sister and I laughed about together? My breath catches and I choke. Drawing my knees up and cradling the phone so that its dim picture is right in front of my eyes. So she's real. I jump at the voice, reaching up to dash my tears away. But Jules' eyes are already on my face. He's already seen me crying. She's real. I look back at the phone, eyes hungry for the sight of her face. Trapped behind a rock fall, with bloodthirsty mercs on the other side, under countless tons of rock and sand on a planet so far from home I can't imagine the distance. Without enough air to catch my ride back, even if we could get back that way. I'm just trying to look at Evie, and not at the battery symbol flashing urgently in the corner of the screen. You were right, Jules says, lowering the breather mask from his face. He's moved over to my side so he can look at the picture of my sister. She's beautiful. She looks just like you. That makes me laugh, but I'm still crying. And I end up half snorting and lifting my arm so I can wipe my nose on my sleeve before I start dripping snot. Liar. I'm not lying. His voice is quiet as he says it. And abruptly, I remember why there was a distance between us. And the warmth of him seems to pull away, even though our bodies are still. Not this time. I keep my eyes on my phone, knowing it could go dark at any moment. But I wish I could look up at Jules, too. I was never going to join them, Jules. I wasn't lying to you either, about Evie or about me. That was the lie, back there with them. Not this. It feels more important than ever that he knows this. That he hear the truth from me, even if he's already seen it in my face or felt it as I passed him the breather. It feels strangely vital that he understand without having to dig for it, or guess, or decipher my expression. I don't know what waits for us on the other side of that door, but I need him to see me truly before we go through it. Jules lifts the mask for another breath, but I can tell it's as much to buy himself time to answer. But even after he's done, he's quiet for a while before letting that air out in a sigh. I don't know what's real anymore. I just know I have to be here. I have to find answers for my dad. For myself. I'm real. My voice sounds thin and quiet against the stone. And I'm here. I lift my head, searching for his face in the dim lantern light. I'm here, I said. What I meant was, I'm with you. The words I'd meant as reassurance sound instead like a promise. He opens his mouth to reply, but before he can, the light flickers. I know before I look down that it's not the lantern. It's my phone. The screen's dark. Evie's face is gone. In a moment of blind panic, I can't even remember what the picture looked like. And I wasn't watching when it went away. I wasn't looking at her those last precious seconds. And I can never get it back. I'm crying again, holding the phone in my palm like it had been a living thing, cradling it like it's the loss of this pile of plastic and circuitry and computer chips that's broken my heart. Then Jules' arm is around me, and he's easing the phone away from my hand with the other and pulling me in against his chest. We lie down that way, pressed together, legs entwined in the warmth of his sleeping bag, the breather mask between us. We pass the mask back and forth in the dark, finding each other's hands and fingers and faces by touch. And when I sleep, he wakes me after a time to press the mask against my face. And after an hour or two, I do the same for him, binding ourselves together as we prepare to face whatever waits on the other side of that final door. All night we learn each other's hands and lips as we share this single tie to life. The warmth of his skin, still on the plastic mask, each time he fits it to the curve of my own face. Each touch is more intimate than any kiss. Our minds half waking, half dreaming. Our two bodies sharing one breath. I'm torn from sleep by the ground quaking beneath me. I gasp, eyes flying open to meet Jules's, his fingers still splayed gently on the mask over my face. Sleepy, confused. I would think I was dreaming, but for the alarm written so clearly on Jules's face, it's like I'm looking in a mirror. Then the air split by sound. A massive boom followed by the roar of falling rock, and the ricocheting, multifaceted echo of the initial crack of stone. We both bolt upright, tangled together, but moving as one. My voice is hoarse from the dry air in the breather, and hoarse with exhaustion, and hoarse with sleep. That was an explosion, I gasp. That wasn't a natural rockfall. I know, Jules replies, disentangling himself from me so he can grab his pack and shove his gear back into it. That was a demolition charge. I'm struggling up as well, the breather in one hand, my dead phone in the other, staggering in the sudden cold outside his sleeping bag. If they've blasted through the rockfall, it means one thing. We're out of time.
Chapter 12. Jules. Okay, I mutter, trying to force myself to calm down. Okay, the door. Why didn't I look at it last night? But I know the answer to that, because I was so tired and so short of oxygen, I couldn't think straight. But now, we've only got the time it'll take Liz, Javier, and the others to navigate the traps we passed on our way here. And given the trail we left them, that won't be long at all. Mia lifts her flashlight to shine it on the door for me, stepping back so the beam takes in the whole of it, silent as she waits for me to translate the glyphs. The ones carved on the door are the only features in this otherwise empty chamber. I can feel her presence at my back. But now her silence is supportive. Something's changed between us in the night. We both still have questions. We both still see the chasm between us. But somehow, we're a we again. The glyphs seem to swim together, new combinations I've never seen tangled in with the old. Translating them isn't like reading any language I know. It's about absorbing all their possible meanings and then allowing them to sit together in your mind until suddenly, like one of those optical illusion puzzles, you can see what they say. It's talking about energy, I mutter, frowning. About... not the sun. Mia, I don't know. She stays silent, and for that I'm grateful. This isn't the moment to point out to me that I don't know could be a death sentence. Here, I say softly, lifting my free hand to trace a line that curves down to the lower right-hand side of the huge double doors. There's something I'm supposed to focus on here. As if I... There's a small square carved into the wall where the curve of the glyphs ends, and I press my fingers against it. With a soft click, the section I'm touching slides out, a rectangle not even as big as my hand, and it's hollow. Something glints inside, crystalline, something resembling the undying artifacts we've studied, and my heart sinks. No, no, no! What is it? Mia asks, stepping forward to look down at it, then glancing back over her shoulder, as if Liz is only steps away, rather than several rooms. A piece of tech goes here, I think, I say, barely able to speak the words. A piece of undying tech, which we don't have. We must have missed something. Perhaps there was some key we were supposed to pick up, and we didn't see it, or it was in one of the collapsed rooms. I'm stumbling over the words. I don't know. What? Her voice is sharp. No, it can't. Jules, we haven't come across bridges made of songs and past spikes shooting up from the floor and through rocks falling from the ceiling to hit this door and not have a stupid key. We don't need a key. We'll break in. We'll pick the lock. There has to be something. Pick the lock. I'm staring at the circuitry in the slot. I yank off my wrist unit, which is earth-tech, but at least conductive, holding it over the little chamber. But it's no good. It won't stretch one end to the other. I can't even pretend to make it fit. I need something the right size. And an instant later, I know what. The realization a second punch in the gut. Your phone, I say. I think your phone will fit. But it's dead, she protests, and I know that's not her only reluctance. Of course it's not. It's still conductive, I reply. I'm sorry, but you're no use to Evie if you die trying to hold on to a picture of her. She nods, and though I can see what it costs her in the tightness of her mouth, she doesn't hesitate. She digs the phone out from her pocket, shoving it into the hollow, and it's a perfect fit. We exchange a glance, surprised, relieved, confused, as it retracts back into the stone once more, and inside the huge doors we hear the familiar grinding of gears and machinery that tells us the temple's about to unleash something new. We tense, ready to duck or leap, to make a quick and desperate play for survival. But then the doors simply slide open, retracting into the rock on either side. We both flick up our lights to look through, but they illuminate little of the dark chamber waiting beyond it, and we don't have time for the caution we've both learned over the last few days. I reach down to curl my hand around hers, and she weaves her fingers through mine and squeezes. Whatever this is, we'll do it together. We take one step through the archway, onto the first paving stone inside. I feel it click, and a jolt of fear goes through me. Are we standing on a pressure plate? Is something swinging at us through the darkness even now? But all that happens is a rumble of stone as the doors grind back into their original position, sealing behind us once more. Mia turns. I let go of her hand reluctantly, and uses her whole body weight to shove against one of the doors, failing to budge it. Well, she mutters, at least we'll hear them trying to get through. She doesn't say what we're both thinking. Her phone is lost now, sealed into the wall on the other side. Let's see if this place has, oh, I don't know, maybe an exit sign somewhere. Together we swing our flashlights up once more, illuminating a chamber with huge, vaulted ceilings and something in the center, a large mass that I can't make out. The room itself is immense, but I don't see a single glyph to explain why this place should be important. My twin goals beat like drums in my head. I have to find out why the Nautilus led me here. What could possibly justify a warning hidden in a transmission, in a temple, in the very architecture of this place? And we have to find a way out of here that isn't back the way we came, because if Liz catches up with us, I don't think she's going to be in the mood to negotiate. Come on, Mia mutters, edging out carefully, testing every step before she commits her weight, as she's learned to do. A little slower now we've got more solid rock between us and Liz. I keep my flashlight down, examining the floor in front of her, making sure I'm following in her steps exactly. When she stops abruptly, I fetch up behind her with a bump, sliding one hand quickly around her waist to make sure I don't knock her forward onto untested ground. She tenses a moment, then leans back into me. What did you see? I ask, lifting my gaze. There's something... Hold on. She shuts off her light, and at her gesture, I do the same. Up there, Jules. And so there is. Very faint, high above us, there's a steady, pale spot of illumination that does nothing to dispel the darkness of the room, but has an entirely different quality to the light from our flashlights. My heart thumps. It could be some sort of residual power signature from the door, I make myself say. Or a trap. Because what I want it to be so very badly, and what I know she's thinking too, is that it could be sunlight. And if it's sunlight, it might be a way out. They would give us light after all this time and make it a trap, she mutters, cynicism almost as thick as the darkness surrounding us. Come on, what do you want us to do with it? Maybe a stone just came loose up there, I suggest, but we both flick our lights back on, swinging them around the chamber in search of a clue. It's Mia who finds it, letting out a little victory cry, as she squeezes back past me to hurriedly retrace our steps to the door once more. And now I see what she sees. Running down from the blackness of the ceiling, there's a set of cables made of a strange silvery-gray material that looks almost wet in the light. She swings her light across to the other side of the door, and there's a second set. They both rise to meet one another at the top of the huge doorway and disappear into the dark above. Beneath each set of cables, sitting parallel with the wall, is a huge lever. The old Mia would have simply started hauling on it without a second thought, but she's learned, and she looks back at me. Can you see any reason I can't pull on this? I can think of a dozen nasty things that might happen, I admit. But we can't stand here for eternity either. The cables are visible, and so are the levers. So they're not intended to be a hidden trap. I think we might as well pull as not. I've made my way over to join her now, and by the light of my torch I can see her faint, wry smile. Perhaps I was supposed to say something slightly more comforting. I'm not good with cues. Just in case, I add, it's been a pleasure knowing you. She snorts. It's been a hellish nightmare, Oxford. Well, I'm English, I point out. I'm quite good at enjoying myself under even the most miserable of circumstances, and I did like riding the skimmer bike. I'm joking, playing for another chance to see one side of her mouth tug up in that reluctant smile, but it's true. Parts of this trek have been a pleasure. Though I've learned things I wish I didn't know about my fellow human beings, I've learned some things I'm glad to know as well. I've met Mia. Together, we're something more than we are apart. Something more than I've ever been before. Something I don't want to give up. I'd like more time to pass that thought, but she's grabbed the lever, and after a gentle pull on it does no good, she's applying all of her weight to trying to move the thing down to a horizontal position. Ancient machinery groans above us, and the light up at the apex of the ceiling intensifies ever so slightly, like a beam being focused. There's not enough room for two sets of hands on the lever, but I reach up to grab the cables, leaning backward and letting them take my weight. It's not like any material I've ever felt, strong and unyielding as metal, but somehow seeming to squirm under my touch in a way that makes my stomach turn. But slowly I take up more slack, and the light brightens, the beam growing stronger and broader. There's no mistaking it. It's daylight, but so far above us we have no hope of reaching it. This set of cables is attached to something like a retractable roof, or a sunshade over a skylight. "What's it for?" I mutter. "Why did they want us to do this?" But when I glance across at her, Amelia's not looking around. She's visible in the dim light, looking at the second set of cables on the other side of the door. "I've got a feeling," she murmurs, and I know to wait as she pauses, let her complete the thought. I've picked up on these little cues over the last few days. She's thinking, and the further outside the box her thoughts go, the more intensely she goes silent. I'm repaid for biting my tongue when she continues. "In Chicago," she says, voice taut with excitement. "Cell reception sucks. Something to do with protons or ions, or something in the desert winds, I don't know. Anyway, sometimes I'd earn some cash playing lookout for one of the gangs, and since you can't just text, and you definitely can't shout to raise the alarm, you need a visual signal. At night, it's this." She flickers her flashlight on and off, the change still visible in the faint daylight. "But during the day, you use mirrors." She swings her flashlight up to where the cables divide, branching out and angling every which way around the room. I have absolutely no idea what she's talking about. "But there aren't any." She walks across to the other side of the door, grabbing the lever there and throwing her weight back against it. "If there is one, it would be a way to redirect," she says, then falls silent to swing her weight against the second lever again. It doesn't budge for a moment, and then, with another round of grinding machinery, slowly it begins to lower from vertical to horizontal, Amelia's small frame hanging off it. The beam of sunlight begins to strengthen and brighten, and I can make out the outline of a reflective disc, and another set to catch its light once it rotates into place, before the reflected sunlight grows too bright for me to look at it. Then, between one heartbeat and the next, as the mirrors align, the chamber transforms into a sea of rainbows. Sunlight shatters across every surface in the room in a dazzling, shocking flash, and from somewhere to my left, there's an undignified shriek as Mia comes barreling straight into me. My arms go around her automatically, and they stay there as our surroundings blaze to life with a brilliance that's momentarily blinding. My vision's dancing with stars and sparks, and as I try to blink away the tears and focus, she turns in my arms to gaze out at the chamber of light. "Holy!" She trails off, staring at the beams of light, lips parted in awe. As the cables above us groan and settle, the rainbows glimmer, and Mia's wonder is writ clear on her face. "It's so beautiful," she whispers, face tilted up toward the domed ceiling and walls covered in the fractured rainbows. "Do you think they knew?" She finally tears her gaze away, just enough to look up at me. knew what beauty was. My heart slamming against my chest. And it's not just that I'm holding her in my arms again, that I'm gazing down at her, her mouth only a breath from mine. It's that in this instant, she's me, back in Valencia, opening herself to exploration, to curiosity. It's not just that for a moment she's sharing in my thrill of discovery. She's experiencing it. She understands. As she reaches out across the millennia to the undying, to wonder if they knew what beauty was, to wonder why they created something so delicate and perfect, she's opening her mind to all the possibilities they represent. She's communicating with them by picking up the stories they left behind and adding her own words, asking her own questions. This is what I do, what exploration and archaeology is, and in this moment, Mia's in it with me. In this moment, all our questions and suspicions about the undying are set aside, as we share this thing with them, left for us all this time. I think they must have, I murmur, known what beauty was. Look what they made. Whoa, Jules, look what else they made, she murmurs, eyes no longer on the ceiling, but staring toward the center of the room. Illuminated by the refracted sunlight, a huge monolith stands there, a towering, jagged piece of black stone. Invisible in the darkness before, the massive stone structure is impossible to miss now that we're not distracted by the beauty of the lighting. It's nothing like the red and blue-gray and creamy colors of the Gaian bedrock in this area, or the metallic stone the Undying use to build. It's nothing like I've seen anywhere on this planet. It's at least twice my height, and its edges are jagged, save for one side, which has been cut and polished to marble smoothness. It stands atop a low stone plinth, and a huge circle made of the same stone frames it like a picture. It's the centerpiece of the room, no doubt, but I have no idea what it's for. Mia steps away from me, and we both move cautiously across the floor, though we're more and more certain there are no traps here. This is the end of the hunt. It's whatever we came to find. We've passed the tests, and the traps are behind us. The secret Nautilus equation buried in the broadcast, each hidden spiral scratched into the stone rooms of this temple and woven into its very architecture, they all led me here. And now I'll find out why. We shine our lights up, and now that we can trace the cables across the vaulted ceiling, we see that instead of the one or two mirrors Mia supposed might be used to light the chamber, there are dozens upon dozens, all angled now toward a multifaceted crystal set up near the ceiling. It scatters the sunbeam into rainbow fragments that paint the walls in swathes of color, daylight bright. The purpose of the huge chunk of rock and the stone frame that arches around it is considerably less clear. I stand in front of the polished side, staring up at it, but it's completely free of glyphs or instructions. This must be what we're meant to see, I say. There's only one thing in the room. This is the final room, Mia says. But... She trails off, turning in a slow circle, taking in the rainbow-clad walls that enchanted her a minute before. Nothing, she says, her voice dropping suddenly. No way out. There's just this hunk of rock. There must be something, I say, but I'm echoing her movement, spinning in a circle, and my heart's dropping with every second. How did I fail to look for another door? Because it was dark at first, and then the rainbows, and Mia's wonder at them, and my own anticipation, and I... There's no exit. We're trapped here, and Liz is on her way, and there's no sign of the Nautilus, or what it means. The vent, I try, squinting up at where the sunlight is, pushing aside the question of the Nautilus for a few moments. It's of no use to us if we're dead.
It's too high,
Mia replies, voice still quiet, staring at the huge rock in the middle of the room, as though it's to blame for our predicament.
We don't have a rope long enough. Our climbing gear wouldn't reach, even if we had a way to toss it up and secure it.
She doesn't even have to look up to be sure.
We're going to die here, Jules.
The scattered light does nothing to hide the distress on her face, her reddened eyes and nose, the exhausted desperation in her gaze. So much for the wonder of discovery. Impending doom will do that to you. Her voice breaks as she speaks again.
We're trapped in a place nobody but you could ever reach, except for the trained scaver crew that's coming through that door to kill us as soon as they get here and plant explosives. And even if they pick the wrong passageway, or they can't break in, we've got food for maybe a week, a breather that'll last less than that. And there's not even a pebble-sized scrap of tech here we could use to bargain our way off the planet, let alone for Evie.
Her whole body's tensing, hands curling to fists at her sides. And when I take a step toward her, she turns sharply, stalking around to the other side of the monolith, putting it between us.
Deus,
I mutter, running one hand through my hair, grabbing a handful of it in frustration. There has to be a way out of this, and we have to find it now. Liz won't hesitate to shoot Mia the moment she sees her, and I won't be far behind, either because I won't stand by and let Mia be hurt, or because Liz will realize I'm done cooperating. Which means we need to find an exit, and find it fast. I close my eyes. If this whole journey is the Undying's version of a test, determining our worthiness as a species, then there must be an answer. Unless we're not worthy, my panicked mind supplies. Unless the solution is beyond what we can reason. Then Mia's voice cuts through my tangled thoughts, coming from the other side of the rock.
Jules, what does Pergite si audatis mean?
She speaks the words haltingly, cautiously. I blink.
When did you learn to speak Latin?
I didn't,
she says, her voice thin. And as I make my way around the plinth to find her, she looks across at me with huge eyes, then points down at the base of the plinth.
It's carved right there.
I look down, and sure enough, there the letters are, carved into the base of the stone. Pergite si audatis. My throat is dry, my heart a frantic drum in my ears. Mia's looking at me, her alarm spiking when she sees whatever's written on my face. She's waiting for me to explain, and it takes all my effort to force myself to speak.
It means,
onward, if you dare.
Chapter 13. Amelia. Latin. In a temple on the other side of the galaxy, built by creatures who were extinct long before Rome ever existed. My mind's spinning, and I know Jules is as thrown as I am. This message is for us, I say, my voice hoarse. For humans. Yes, he whispers. I mean, it's freaking Latin. I actually squeak the last word. What the hell, Jules? They use the same words in the broadcast, he says, dazed, his gaze barely focused. Onward, if you dare. And now, here it is. It's... The test was always for us. It was us they were testing for worthiness. I don't like this, I murmur, staring up at the black monolith. like it might move. I don't trust it. We've been doing our best to explain everything away. 50,000 years, convergent evolution, but I've been explaining it away. He corrects me, still soft. You've been asking what other ways they might be similar to us, whether they could lie, deceive. We have your answer now. But the answer's impossible, I reply. The answer is that they've been seeking humanity, targeting Earth all along. That's impossible. And yet, there it is. I think something's broken in his head. Intellectual overload or whatever. He just keeps shaking it slowly, staring at the Latin. A sound, tiny and far away, yanks me back to myself. Maybe I'm imagining it. Jules certainly doesn't hear it, too lost in his own mind. But it reminds me nonetheless that whatever we've just discovered, we're still in a race for survival. I want to give him a shake, to shout that Liz is on our heels. And she won't bother to solve the door puzzle. She'll just blast her way through it. But I need him thinking. Okay, I say, trying to make myself calm. It says, onward if you dare. That means there's got to be a way to actually go onward, right? I mean, I don't like this, and I have more questions than I can count right now, but we know Liz will definitely shoot us if she catches up with us. So onward, still looking better than our other options. Jules's mouth opens a few times before he actually manages a response. Right. Yes. There should be a way. So maybe there's a puzzle here, too. Something to do with this thing. I move forward toward the hulking stone structure in the center of the room, forcing myself to look at it and nod toward the letters carved there. It'll turn into a ladder or a trapdoor, or it'll open some invisible second door in here or something. Maybe we could try and climb this frame. But even as I say it, I'm eyeing its smooth slope, without so much as a crack or chip for a toehold. Maybe. Jules is still so shaken, he's barely registering my words. But I don't. The Latin just says onward. There's nothing about a puzzle, no glyphs like in the other rooms. If this is the end of the maze, where are our answers? The Nautilus... Okay. I take a breath, coming up alongside him. Part of me wants to take his hand, drown out my fear with the feel of his fingers twining through mine. But I need him thinking about that statue thing, not me. Okay, Jules, forget the Latin. Forget the glyphs. Forget the Nautilus. Forget the Undying. Forget Gaia. Forget everything else in this temple. You're an archaeologist. Where do we start? Jules gives himself a little shake, as if shedding the confusion and fear and wonder. We observe. We look for wear patterns that might tell us if this was used for anything. We look for any fragments around it of other artifacts. Anything that might suggest why this would have been important to the civilization that built it. He starts poring over every centimeter of the thing. And while I do the same, I have no idea what I'm looking for. It's obvious as I get closer that the structure does something. Sections of the stone are cut through by narrow, almost invisible lines that would allow the different parts to move if operated by some invisible mechanism. Another distant sound, muffled by the thick stone door, slithers into the quiet and jacks up my heart rate. Jules hears it this time, and his eyes meet mine, widening. Ignore it. I'm talking fast, but trying to sound calm. We've got time. Focus. But inside, I'm screaming. Figure this thing out, or we're going to get blown up or shot or tied up and left here to die. It feels like hours before Jules gives a little exclamation, though I know it's only moments. I'm quick to join him where he's crouched at the base of the statue, inspecting something half-concealed in the shadows. It's another of the scratched carvings he's been tracking. The curve of the Nautilus shape, a line radiating out from it. Taking a breath to steady his hand, he angles his wrist unit so he can photograph it. Then his finger trails across to hover above a shape next to it that's similar, but definitely not the same. This shape isn't scratched into the surface. It stands out in relief, like it's been embossed on the stone. See this? His voice is quiet, tense with concentration. He's gesturing without touching at the curl of carving and the shadow it casts. I think it's an alpha.
A what?
This time, I'm not able to keep the impatience from my voice. It's the first letter of the ancient Greek alphabet. The curl he's indicating looks kind of like a stick drawing of a fish, but it could also be a badly drawn lowercase a. Didn't the ancient Greeks speak Latin? Well, no, they spoke Greek, actually. A number of different forms of Latin were the dominant languages during the Roman Empire that followed, although it depends on which area of the empire you're talking about, because at times it occupied territories that stretched into what's now Jules. Right, right. I think this statue is another puzzle. I think it might just be a simple alphabet puzzle. Starting with this alpha thing? He nods, tracing the shape of the letter in the air by the carving. Good enough for me. I reach for it, and I know we're both holding our breath. It stands out from the stone, so it's easy enough to grip. Under my fingers, the letter gives a little, the layer of stone it's carved into seeming to separate from the rest. And I wrench harder. The small tile with the alpha on it twists a quarter turn to the right, then clicks inward. The frame encircling the polished surface of the monolith shudders, and suddenly the stone sheds a cloud of ancient dust and sand and comes to life. More stone carvings push their way to the surface until Greek letters ring the entire frame. Before we have time to inspect them, a rumbling and shower of dust from the cavern wall behind us makes us both jump to our feet, ready to run if the ceiling's coming down. Though, I know we're both thinking, run where? The source of the sound is another set of characters, emerging from the stone wall, a foot high at least. Suddenly there, at head height, where there was nothing before, just like the letters on the statue. The words aren't Greek. They're written in another alphabet I can't read, but I recognize it. What? Is that Chinese? I gasp. Jules is staring at it in silent, baffled awe. But before either of us can speculate, we hear a sound that leaves absolutely no doubt that Liz and her people are close. Voices. They're on the other side of the door. Jules' gaze swings to meet mine, and in that moment we have no need of speech. I'm immediately turning to scan the frame. What's the next letter in the Greek alphabet? Beta. It looks like an uppercase B with a longer tail. We search the ring-like frame, moving fast. Jules calling out descriptions and both our eyes searching for the letters that came to the surface when I twisted the alpha stone. He finds most of them, eyes trained to see them. But every so often, I'm the one who leaps forward and twists the next piece of the puzzle. Each time we turn a new letter, more words emerge from the walls around us, sometimes 4 or 5 sentences at a time. They appear on every wall of the chamber, until the whole place is covered with words and more languages than I knew existed. At one point, a series of lines pop out that look barely more than chicken scratch. But as I stare at them, I remember vaguely a lesson from before I dropped out of school. Cuneiform, it's called. From some ancient civilization before even the Greeks and Romans. What the hell is going on? The fact that Liz and her people aren't already inside means they haven't found the little slot that contains my phone, the key to unlocking the door. But I doubt they only brought enough explosives for one cave-in. And if they blast their way in here, we're dead. If the explosion doesn't kill us, Liz will. She might keep Jules alive for a little while, but only until he's outlived his usefulness.
I'm telling you, shouts Jules, urgency lifting his voice. It looks just like a lowercase W.
And I'm telling you, I retort, that the only W-looking thing was the psi we just pushed. Like a W and a Y got busy with each other.
Look, harder. It's got to be here. Omega, it's the last letter.
I'm searching, eyes watering with effort and the brightness of the refracted sunlight flooding the room, when my gaze suddenly snaps into focus. Not on the frame around the monolith, but on the wall behind it. There's a phrase there. In English. The worthy will rise into the stars. I don't stop now to marvel at the fact that I'm reading something from an ancient temple. I can't worry that it's cryptic, that I can only think of it literally, that a naive college student and an uneducated scavenger girl are clearly not worthy in any possible way. I just look up. Jules, what does an uppercase omega look like?
All the rest have been lowercase,
I know, but it's the last one, and those words, it says rise. What's that at the top?
I'm pointing. Rise into the stars. To a semicircular carving at the very center of the top of the frame.
Me Hercule,
Jules mumbles. Give me a boost, I demand, hurrying to his side. He kneels and cups his hands obligingly. And then he's heaving me upward, grunting with the effort. I can just barely touch the top of the frame, but it's enough. My fingers graze the Omega's edge, and the letter twists and sinks into the frame. The ground beneath us quakes, and as Jules cries out and I go tumbling down, I'm thinking, oh God, they've blown a hole in the wall. This is it. But when I land on top of Jules, who half grunts, half gasps at the impact, I'm scrambling up to discover that the door is still intact. The rumbling is coming from the structure. I've been so focused on Jules, so desperate to keep him working, translating, thinking, that I haven't had time to process my own fear. So the sudden wave of hope that washes over me is so visceral, I'd fall to my knees if I weren't already in a heap on the ground with Jules. The structure is a puzzle, and it is doing something. Opening a door, creating a staircase, I don't care what it is, as long as it gets us out of this dead-end death trap. We stumble to our feet in time to see a mind-bending ripple flow through the solid rock of the monolith. I jerk back, Jules staggering with me. His fingers are tangled through mine, I realize, but I have no idea who grabbed for whose hand. Another ripple flows through the polished center of the statue, and abruptly it doesn't look like stone anymore. Its surface looks like an oil slick, semi-reflective and fluid. I take it back. I want a goddamn staircase. What the hell is that?
I draw in close to Jules' side. His warmth, a comfort in the chill air that's humming now with a strange sort of energy. Like we're standing beneath a set of power lines, or on an open field in a thunderstorm. I don't... But Jules stops abruptly, his eyes widening. Wait. I have seen this before. Don't you recognize this? It looks like the surface of the portal. The one that brought our shuttles here to Gaia. I spent that trip sealed up in a packing crate, remember? I reply. For all my dreams of exploring space, all I got was the inside of a box. And the utter, gut-wrenching, mind-searing pain of going through the portal. The memory of it makes me want to shrink back from the oily-looking thing in front of me. I can't do it again. I can't. Not unless it's to go home. To go back to Evie. We can't just leap in blindly, Jules is saying, gazing at the portal in wonder. We don't know why they built this place. We don't know why they were testing us. Not anymore. We still don't know what danger the Nautilus was warning against. This is the room, Mia. This is it. Why I came here. They led us here, and we have to find the answer. This portal could be the very threat we're meant to avoid. The spiral's carved right there in this thing's base. We need more time. We don't have time, I remind him, hating that I have to be the one to say it. We're out of options. Mia, we can't go through this thing not knowing where it goes. It could take us to some other planet. One where we'd need more than breathers to survive. It could send us straight into a black hole. It could send us into the middle of outer space to die for all we know. At least I'd get to see what space looked like before my eyeballs exploded in the vacuum. Look at these walls. I give his hand a tug to turn him, so the light on his helmet scans across the multiple languages and characters that emerged while we were unlocking the portal. These are human languages. I have no idea what that means, but I also don't know why the Undying would have a path leading straight to this portal, and a message telling us to keep going, in a language we understand, in literally dozens of languages humans might understand. If this portal were going to kill us. You're assuming their motives. We have no choice, I interrupt him. I don't know what's going on, but I do know that we are going to die when Liz and her people come through that door. I'd rather take my chances with the portal. But he's shaking his head, setting his jaw and gazing around at the walls. The answers are here, Mia. He's taking pictures again. Pictures! For the love of... Of the walls and their multi-language messages. His eyes, burning with that fervor that lights them, every time he gets buried in the secrets of the Undying. These walls. This is why I came to Gaia. What I risked my life to find. Translating these messages could be the key to proving my father was right not to trust blindly the technology the Undying left us. These temples were built long before these languages ever existed. You can't tell me to leave this behind. I close my eyes, trying to take a deep breath. If this room were filled with valuable artifacts, I'd be grabbing every single one I could fit into my pack. For Evie. These messages are his version of that. I can't deny him the chance to do what he came here to do just because I've failed. And beyond that, he's right. There are questions here we have to find answers to. I glance at the door, which still stands between us and Liz, and let my breath out slowly. Maybe there's a place to hide that we missed, I say softly,
I'll look around now that we've unlocked the... But I don't get to finish.